Now Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. Ready for the spontaneous, unrehearsed conference are four of America's top news reporters. Their questions do not necessarily reflect their point of view, but may be their way of getting a story. Now here's the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. Our guest is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator J. William Fulbright of Arkansas. As the Cold War continues, the problems of foreign affairs have assumed a dominating importance to the lives of all of us. They have become matters of grave controversy. The Berlin crisis and the foreign aid program are two of the problems in which Senator Fulbright's committee is vitally interested. Senator Fulbright began his career as an educator. At the age of 34, he was elected president of the University of Arkansas. Throughout his 16 years in Congress, he has devoted much of his attention to foreign policy matters. In 1943, he sponsored the resolution which became a forerunner to the establishment of the United Nations. He also was the author of legislation setting up the student exchange program. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview Senator Fulbright, are Peter Lissagor of the Chicago Daily News, David Brinkley of NBC News, James Reston of the New York Times, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Senator Fulbright, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Senator, the other day you said this: if the summit conference doesn't hold some prospect of benefit to the Western world, I wouldn't go. Judging by results thus far at the foreign ministers' conference, do you think the summit conference holds any prospects of benefit to the Western world?
Well, I don't think that the prospects are very good, but I think I would be inclined to go. I tried to leave the impression the other day that I think, in view of the particular circumstances in the Russian governmental setup, I think it's worthwhile to go to a summit conference, unless they give evidence of lack of any good faith or any intention to discuss seriously our mutual differences. And I doubt if they've given that impression yet. I'm inclined to think that it'll be worthwhile to go.
Senator, in the light of the past experience we've had in dealing with members of the Soviet Union, what do you think we could accomplish at a summit meeting?
I think that we can come to know them better, that we can get in mutual discussions of our differences, that there will gradually be elicited the real attitude, the real differences that exist. I'm not very optimistic, I may say, about reaching a solution, an agreement which will be a solution to all our problems. I think this is a long process. It would go on year after year for a number of years. I would hope that so long as we're still meeting and discussing our differences, that there'd be less inclination to resort to war, to outright hot war.
Senator, the leaders of the Soviet Union seem to think that we're already committed to go to a summit conference. Do you think that we are committed to go regardless of what
happens?
No,
I do not. I do not. But I have a feeling that Mr. Khrushchev is very anxious to have one, and that he will not permit his representative there to be so rude and so lacking in good manners, and also a discussion of something in Berlin that will enable us to go.
Senator, is there any likelihood that you or other members of your committee would be represented at the summit conference?
I would think not. This, after all, is especially an executive function. I don't quite see that members of the legislature would play any important part. Perhaps if an agreement which would probably be submitted to the Senate for ratification was in the offing, that they might be invited. But I would say that's a long way off.
Mr. Reston.
Senator, the president said the other day about the summit question that he would not go under threats. Are you saying that you differ with the president about this point?
Under threats, that would mean, I think, a lack of good faith, and we should not be subjected to threats. If they are going to show such ill manners, such rudeness as that, then I'd say we shouldn't go.
Well, it's not a question, though, of manners. It's a question of whether, as I understand the president's position, whether they would state in advance that they would not revise the question of denying us our rights in Berlin for the duration, until Germany is actually united. Unless they said that, he indicated he would not go to a summit.
Well, if they make it that positive that they will not do it, then I think they foreclose any possibility. But I can't imagine they will make it that positive if they want to have one. I mean, I think there's no formula that I can think of that as a rule of thumb we'll have one. But I, assuming Mr. Khrushchev is serious in his request to have one, which I think he is, for reasons of his own, I can't imagine that he would be that obvious in his threats, and I agree with the president as far as the threats go. I don't think I differ with the president, really. When you put these qualifications, I think the likelihood is that that Khrushchev is not going to be so adamant and so arbitrary, and that therefore we're very likely to be able to go to the summit. Not only once, I think probably several times.
Mr. Brinkley.
Well, Senator, sending the president or having the president go to a summit meeting is certainly our most formidable or effective diplomatic device. Do you think it should be used as freely as is now being advocated? That is, going to a meeting without any assurance that anything worthwhile will be accomplished there?
Well, I'm inclined to think this is a development which accompanies the rise of this unusual system of government that is unusual in the sense that it's a very powerful one now, with the dictatorial system in which these representatives presently have no independent authority, and Mr. Khrushchev has evidenced a great desire to play a leading part, and I think we should adapt ourselves to it if we possibly can. The ordinary diplomatic channels are not working. I think it's worth exploring it. There are a lot of other new things developing in these recent years in the economic field. This is one in the political field, and I think we have to explore it and make the best of it. We really don't progress very far in advancing our own interests if we merely sit back and say nothing can be done. What's the alternative? If you can think of a better alternative, I'm perfectly willing to consider one. But I think to sit and do nothing but glare at one another and build more atomic bombs has very little future in it.
Mr. Lissagor.
Senator, when the Russians have wanted to do business with the West, they seem to do it on any level. Now, three of the major things that they've agreed to since the war have been the ending of the Berlin blockade, which was not done on the summit, the ending of the Korean War, and the Austrian peace treaty. These were all done through diplomatic channels. What virtue, special virtue, is there in a summit meeting, since the president himself has said that the last summit meeting accomplished zero?
This idea is not mine. I didn't originate the idea of summits. I mean, this man, who is the head of a very great nation, says he wants one. Now, our position is, well, we say no. We will not have one, we won't do a thing, and we sit here. I don't quite see the great fear of having it, and I think psychologically it's rather embarrassing to create the impression you're afraid to have one with him. I see nothing particularly wrong in going and sitting down, assuming we have our wits about us, and I don't know why we shouldn't have, and we talk things over. If nothing comes of it, what's the harm been done? I think we certainly ought to be well briefed to know what we're talking about, and we ought to be able to present before the world. It will be a forum, certainly, that everyone will be paying attention to, and why couldn't we take advantage of it to present an honest statement of the case of the West under these circumstances? It would be just as advantageous to us as to the Russian. There seems to be an assumption that if we go to them, then we're going to suffer a tremendous propaganda defeat of some kind. I can't quite see why we should.
Senator, I wonder if I could change the subject just a bit. Before he came over here, West German Chancellor Adenauer was said to have been disturbed by some of your statements about making accommodations with the Russians, disengagement about which you talked, and so on. As I understand it, he saw you while he was here. In fact, may have sought you out to talk to you. Can you tell us whether he sought to toughen you up a bit?
No, I didn't get that impression. It's true, he did invite me. In fact, I invited him first. I don't want to make an impression he's around seeking particularly my advice or an opportunity to talk. I invited him to lunch with the committee, and unfortunately, the president invited him the same day, so he had to go there, and then I did talk with him at the embassy for an hour and a half. He didn't give me the impression he was dissatisfied with anything I had said. We talked it over at considerable length. He is not an arbitrary man. He didn't give me that impression. He thinks that we should be very careful of our own interests. But he hopes that someday there will be a basis for accommodation with the Russians.
Did he give you any idea at that meeting that he was going to continue on as chancellor rather than run as president of the German Republic?
No, we didn't mention that. This was before his announcement. He looked well physically. He was certainly alert mentally. And maybe I, along with many other people, I'm sure, that saw him here, were impressed by his good health and virility, perhaps... We contributed to his decision, but unwittingly. We didn't discuss that matter at all.
One other point about Chancellor Adenauer, Senator. Do you judge him to be a man who is inflexible insofar as the Russians are concerned, who is unwilling to concede anything?
No, I do not. I think mutual concessions, that is, if they would do something that would indicate their willingness to be reasonable in the settlement of the problems that grow out of Berlin and in the Central Europe, I think he would be reasonable, too. I don't think he's an inflexible man.
Mr. Spivak.
Senator, you've been very critical of the administration and the way it has administered its foreign policy, in fact, in its foreign policy altogether, haven't you?
No, I wouldn't put it that way. Not altogether, but in specific instances, two or three specific instances. I wouldn't say altogether.
Well, you have no fear, then, that the members of the administration can handle Mr. Khrushchev at a summit conference now. I mean, after our experience, for example, in 1955.
Well, I think that you learn by these mistakes. I think that we were too complacent. We came out of with smug assumption that something had been settled. I think that you have to go through these meetings time and again. I have considerable confidence, if I may say so, in our Secretary of State and the Undersecretary of State and their staff, and I think that they can manage that part of it. The President, of course, as head of state, would go and be representative, but he would have very good assistance. I don't think you should say I've been critical of all that this administration has done.
I said for the most part, not all.
Well, I don't know it'd be most part. There have been two or three outstanding examples, but outside of that, I don't recall that I've been carping about the many things they do that I certainly approve of.
Well, Senator, for example, last summer when our troops were in Lebanon, you said that unless there is a drastic, sweeping revision of our foreign policy and in the execution of that policy, we are heading for far graver troubles than those in which we now find ourselves. That's pretty sweeping.
That related, though, but specifically to that area. You will recall that has rather a long history. I objected to the Aswan Dam, particularly the Aswan cancellation, the Aswan Dam, and the developments that grew out of that. And this is simply a part of that area. I would say that my principal difference has been with regard to the Middle East policy, beginning with the cancellation of the Aswan Dam and then the following up through that on down to Lebanon. Of course, the Lebanese incident itself did not disturb me so much as merely it was an outgrowth of this policy, which I thought was disastrous, and I still think so. That, as a matter of fact, is the main point in which I have criticized them, and far as I can think at the moment, or almost the principal one, various aspects of that particular policy.
Well, Senator, some of your criticism, of course, has been pretty fundamental. More recently, for example, you've said that our foreign policy is inadequate, and that it is, and these were your words, is based in part on a false conception of our real long-term major interests.
Well, if I may elaborate on that a bit, it is true that within the last few days, is illustrating what I mean, with the new mutual assistance program coming up, I offered amendments to this, and I asked the president's support of amendments to put our development loan fund on a long-term basis, and I thought an adequate amount. And the president has, in effect, declined to do that. I don't know, the letter's been made public. You can judge for yourself. He has proposed an alternative method of financing, which I believe to be utterly unrealistic and impossible of accomplishment as our Congress is set up. Now, I realize the president is dealing with a situation that's extremely difficult in our government, that is, and one that I regret, that is the division within the government between the two parties, one having the executive, the other the legislature. So that I don't mean these reflections entirely to be his responsibility, because he didn't create this situation. But I think the president underestimates our capacity on the one hand, our capacity to meet whatever the demands are in the international scene right at the moment, on the one hand, and also the demands, the necessities of it, as in the development loan fund. He's asking for $700 million this year. I proposed $1.5 billion to be made available. I think we can afford it, and I think it's needed. That's the difference.
Mr. Reston.
Senator Fulbright, I thought your criticism went beyond the administration, and that your criticism actually was that it was reflecting a kind of flabby sense of values in the country.
Well, I did in one speech say that. I don't think this should be mutually exclusive. It's either or. I think that the administration, in a sense, reflects this very condition in the country. I think one of the reasons why the president received such an overwhelming majority is because the people are tired of the struggles, and they were wishing and desiring a period of ease and relaxation. And perhaps after these two wars and all that, that this is a very natural thing. But should one not criticize in the hope that the criticism will induce a change in attitude? That's the reason for the criticism. I hope the criticism was not entirely unfounded, and what I hoped was that we would, in our domestic policy, for example, would contribute a great deal more of our resources to education. I think we've fallen down very badly in education. Now, I don't mean that this president is responsible for all of this, but he's the president, he's the man you direct your suggestions to because he happens to be here. I think this failure goes back through all the democratic regimes for 50 years.
Well, leading on from that point, I suppose it's pointless to talk about actual candidates for the presidency, but perhaps not pointless to try to define what are the qualities in a modern American president. Have you got any thoughts about that?
Well, I think he must be very tough, and I think our system needs a very strong president. Particularly under the demands of foreign policy. The presidency is the only national office, you might say, elected on with a national constituency that can represent our national interests. And he must overpower, in a sense, our local prejudices, our local interests, by his strong appeal for assistance, for example, in mutual aid program. If necessary, he should base a tax increase on the demands of our foreign policy. Now, how can a man representing a local constituency expect to succeed in politics if he takes that national attitude? Now, he can respond to the president's request, his urgent request. It isn't profitable for me or any other senator or congressman to forever being advocating foreign aid when you know your own constituents need it just as bad. And certainly mine do, because we're a poor state. And they don't understand my over-eagerness for giving away, as they call it, great sums in foreign fields. So it's the presidency must take the lead, and we would help him. I mean, we will accede to his request. If he puts it another way around, it's going to fail. And I think he makes a mistake in not taking a stronger stand in this field, giving all congressmen and senators, we'll say, an excuse to go along with it. Do I make it clear? This is a political matter.
I think you're making it clear. I was hoping that you would go on and define in what ways he would exercise it. Are you talking about eloquence, personal eloquence, political?
Oh, political. No, what? I'm talking about, well, political management, if you use that word, of the Congress. Our strong presidents have always had in this field, if they are successful, to counteract the parochial interests of our Congress. This is a very difficult system to operate in the foreign field. It wasn't designed for foreign relations. You well know that our founding fathers thought we'd be free of these foreign entanglements. And it is not designed for that. It's a very complicated, difficult system, and I think when you're dealing with foreign relations, you must have a very strong, assertive president who uses all the powers of his office to get his way in these international fields.
Mr. Brinkley.
Senator, you have described for us an almost superhuman being. Who is your candidate for this office?
Well, I haven't selected one. It doesn't matter who you select. I mean, unless you're realistic and he's possible within the field. You probably know that before I supported the Democratic candidate the last two times. As I look at the groups that are now discussed, I have said in public before, and I would repeat again here, I think as of the moment, those who are prominently discussed among the Democrats, that the majority leader has the best qualifications from the point of view of a political leader, that he's demonstrated the capacity to make this almost unmanageable system operate.
Senator Johnson, you...
He is the majority leader, as of the moment. That's who I had in mind. I've said that before, I may say.
Let me ask you another question in relation to the East-West conflict at the moment. Almost every proposal we make to Russia at Geneva and presumably later at the summit relates in some way to the reunification of Germany. Can you foresee a time when that is really likely to come about?
Well, I think the reunification of Germany is in the distant future for some time. And it's not only because of the Russians. I think that the French and other people in Europe still have very grave questions about the immediate reunification of Germany.
You think anyone really wants it?
As of the moment, I doubt that, because the memories of the last war and what happened are still very strong in the minds of people who suffered from that directly. And I can well imagine that they would be, so that I foresee perhaps that this particular division may continue a long time, but I also foresee that if the West is to survive, that we must draw together, economically particularly and politically, in larger and larger units. The significant development, as I see it, is the movement toward a common market in Europe. I would hope the common market in South America will develop, and that then gradually these common markets will be merged in a big common market for the whole Western world. I think that's essential if we're really to hold our own versus the communists. Now, this can't be done overnight and all of a sudden, but these are the significant movements. And I would hope that Germany, Western Germany, and maybe eventually, if we could, Eastern Germany, be merged in a European common market in which they're merged as a part of a unified Europe.
Mr. Lissigor.
Senator Fulbright, do you agree with Senator Mansfield's proposal to end all foreign aid grants, that is, outright dollar gifts, within 3 years' time?
Well, We all would like to do that. I don't believe it's feasible. It is. I think there will continue areas that are such as Taiwan and Turkey, to cite two examples, in which some grants in the nature of defense support will be necessary beyond that period. I do agree with him that this is the area that can be minimized and cut down to a bare minimum, and whatever aid is necessary be transferred to the Development Loan Fund.
Mr. Reston.
Going back to your common market idea, Senator, are you suggesting that we should take the lead in America joining such a...
I think that we should do everything we can to promote the development of the common market in Europe and in South America, and then I think that we should certainly be a part of one. It's been discussed with regard to NATO. That's a good beginning. I would be in favor of that. I say these changes in your economic relations come about gradually. We should be moving in that direction and doing everything we can to promote it.
Mr. Spivak.
Senator, do you think the president will get the $3 billion he's asking for foreign aid this year without any fundamental change in the bill?
Well, I think he will approach it. The House, as you know, has recommended 3-6, and I think that it'll come very close to it. He will, certainly, if he uses his full influence to do it. I regret that he didn't come out strongly for those amendments, which give us a little trading area, so to speak. But I think it won't be cut much more than what the House is cutting.
Gentlemen, I see that our time has just about run out. I'm sure that the panel has many more questions that they could ask, but I think we'll have to save them for the next time Senator Fulbright comes back with us.
Monitor's thanks, then, to Senator J. William Fulbright, Democrat of Arkansas,